thank you all so much for being here. Thanks for moving down. That makes it so much pleasanter for the poet. And thanks for having kids here, too. That's really sweet. My name is Leonard Oakland. I teach here in the English department. And I am pleased and proud to introduce Lori Lamon this afternoon as our poet who is reading. Lori Lamon graduated from Whitworth College in 1978, and she has been teaching at Whitworth, a member of the faculty, since 1985. She's been with us as a faculty member for the last 22 years. She teaches courses that have become legendary among writing students particularly, and literature students as well. She has taught poetry writing, a seminar in Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, and a marvelous course called Poetry of Witness. These among many other courses. But it's not just Lori Lamon's relationship with Whitworth and the fact that she's on the faculty here that is the reason for today's reading. Rather, it's the poet of depth and substance and grace that she has become that brings us together and asks us as a university for Lori to read this afternoon. She's published in over 15 different poetry journals. She has a book available at the table out in the lobby called The Fork Without Hunger. She has a publication in the pipeline called Without Wings. And since poetry publication goes at a little slower pace than Harry Potter books or fiction in general, she has another manuscript ready to go into the pipeline, which will bring together all of the pain poems that many of us have heard at least examples of over these years. She's won awards like the Graves Award in 2002, a Pushcart Prize in 2002, an award from the Artist Trust of Washington in 2005, and then most recently the very, very prestigious Witter Bynner Foundation Award given by Donald Hall, the Poet Laureate of the United States, to two poets, and Lori Lamon was one of them. But again, it's not just awards or teaching history, but it's the poems that many of us have heard and read that makes us want to hear her again, that brings us together to hear this marvelous poet and reader. Welcome, Lori.
Okay, can you hear me? Is that too loud? Loud enough? Okay. All right. Leonard, thank you for that really beautiful introduction. I didn't get nervous until he started saying all those things about me. So it's an honor to have him introduce me, and our relationship goes back many years. He's been part of the journey for me, and one that is continuing. So thank you very much, and thank all of you for being here. When I drove onto campus, I thought, oh my gosh, the game is still going, and even if it isn't, who would come to a poetry reading on such a gorgeous afternoon? So I really appreciate you being here. It means a lot to me, and I'm grateful for Tad Wisner for asking me to do this. How many of you are here for homecoming, actually, who are from other places? And well, thank you so much, and I hear we won the game, which is really important. I was going to make sure I asked that so it would be relevant. I actually even brought a football poem that I thought I would use as my little introduction to the reading. And when Tad asked me to do this, I thought, a poetry reading on homecoming. You know, I just thought, well, that's great. I'm happy to do it. But it just seemed kind of an odd juxtaposition. So I asked my students if they could help me find a poem that maybe I could read about football, since I know nothing about football and would never occur to me to write a poem about football. And the only one I know is really depressing. So Kelly Vinson, if you know her, you can thank her for this poem called Football by Lewis Jenkins. And it's a prose poem, so it just looks like one paragraph. I take the snap from the center, fake to the right, fade back. I've got protection. I've got a receiver open downfield. What the hell is this? This isn't a football. It's a shoe. A man's brown leather Oxford. A cousin to football, maybe. The same skin, but not the same. A thing made for the earth, not the air. I realize that this is a world where anything is possible. And I understand also that one often has to make do with what one has. I have eaten pancakes, for instance, with that clear corn syrup on them because there was no maple syrup, and they weren't very good. Well, anyway, this is different. My man downfield is waving his arms. One has certain responsibilities. One has to make choices. This isn't right, and I'm not going to throw it. I think that's a wonderful poem. Well, when I realized I was going to read that poem, I thought, I need a transition poem, because the poem I was going to open with is one of the pain poems, and it's just kind of a dark transition. So this is my transition. This is a poem that's sort of an autumn poem. It's called Bonsai, and it's a poem that I wrote about a bonsai that I bought for myself. This absolutely beautiful little maple with these beautiful, it had three beautiful red leaves on it. And I put it in a beautiful pot that was on my hearth. Anyway, this is what triggered the poem. It's called Bonsai. Watering the maple, I waited and listened for the soil to take the stream I poured across the black gravel we spread with a spoon, making a river and a river bend. In the late light falling across the garden, the petals of the begonia are as translucent as the skin of the infants, zipped into the carriages their mothers push with one hand as they run each morning, entering and leaving the window's view. There are three new leaves we had not noticed. They do not tremble against my finger. They have not risen up against a single wind, nor have they taken in the clangorous rain. Their silence is set apart from the falling and tearing down that is not yet the earth. I thought I would read some poems from the collection, The Fork Without Hunger, and also some poems from Without Wings, and then a couple of new pieces. This is called Pain Thinks of the First Thing. And the collection that Leonard mentioned, which now is a collection of 40 pain poems, uses pain, the idea, the existence of pain, the experience of pain as a kind of doppelganger, to explore a lot of different things. There are poems called Paintings of History, Paintings of the Garden. The poems range from religion to philosophy to history to just all kinds of different things. So this is called Paintings of the First Thing. Paintings of the First Thing without sleep, without history. The first thing without sound, without memory of sound. Pain thinks of origin's trespass, hoof and cochlea, earth without blossom, without axis or column, the Yangtze without passage, the sea without apparition, and the animals let loose at Peloponnesus. Pain thinks of the first thing without temple water, black as burial's locust and palm, without fruit, without water. Pain thinks of the first thing and drinks it. poems are really dense, I know. The pain poems especially. This one's called Paintings of History. And it was actually triggered when I visited Donald Hall many years ago. He has a lot of beautiful little antiquities in his house, and he showed me this beautiful little blue turquoise Roman bracelet that was for a child. And it was just, it was beautiful. And I stood there and held it and thought about the little child, you know, so many years ago, centuries ago, who wore that. Pain thinks of history. Pulling its arms to its ribcage, pain thinks of a seahorse small as a fern, thinks of ladders and tombs, thinks of ruins architecture, the vertebra's neural arch, the torn net, the artifact. Pain thinks of history without landscape, without bone or infinitive. Pain thinks of the cordoned papyrus, the first and last page. Pain thinks of the cell's enormity sliding open and shut. Pain thinks of history without darkness and digs without darkness, without garbage or marrow. Pain digs without thinking of digging, and the hand and the wrist without history, and the bracelet, child sighs, pain slides up its arm. This poem is called Separating the Flowers, and it was triggered by a gift that someone gave me of a beautiful bouquet of flowers. And as we do with flowers, as they started to die, I would take them out, rinse the rest of the stems that were left behind, maybe trim them, give them fresh water, and sort of pare them down. And as the poem says, it was the tiger lily that lasted the longest. Separating the flowers, I rinsed the stems and lifted the dead blossoms from those still palpable with color and scent. Then set the vase down again like a scale whose one side, unburdened, rises. The tiger lily lasted another week. Lifting it, I thought of Demeter and Mary, outlasting what must have felt, at first, like desertion. And the allusion to Demeter, as you know, was the mother of Persephone, who was swept away to Hades, and her mother, Demeter, threatened the destruction of the entire earth unless she was returned, which is why we have spring, which returns every year. And Mary, in the poem, being the mother of Christ. This is a little lighter. It's called Lithograph Sun Rising by Su Xin Ping, and it was triggered by a beautiful series of lithographs that was in Northwest, what's that journal? Northwest Lit? I'm blanking on the name of the journal right now. The beautiful literary journal that comes out of the University of Oregon. And it had taken one of my poems, and when I got my contributor's copy, I saw this beautiful series of lithographs by this Chinese artist. So I wrote a poem about it. A man greets first light, light apparent on brow and headcloth, the shirt draping hip and knee. His wrists turn the palms out, the way a woman knows with her hands the back of a man sleeping. Knows wind in the garden, having carried the lanterns. Don't speak to me now. Over the wide waters of rain, I hear you. Through the incessant corridor of air that follows the stairway's handrail up and down, morning and night, I hear you. Don't speak to me now. Don't call my name. I have been pulling weeds, twisting the seed heads weighted with stems, following the descent into each small conflagration of root. Digging them up, I bury again the dead I have not begun to forget. called Dragonfly. It's just a little description, but I'll tell you what triggered the poem after I read it. It's really short. Dragonfly. Its arrival with stillness, narrow as a hairpin, the wings, stigmas laid open, and the eyes, yes, like scissor-cut jewels, green and gold and blue, and the wide mouth, not without ambition, waiting and drinking. I was watering, which is where I find a lot of my poems, just out in my little garden watering, and this beautiful dragonfly just landed on a little piece of bark next to where I was watering, and the first thing that I thought was, yeah, it's as narrow as a hairpin. Its body was just so tiny, and I thought, well, that isn't going to make a poem. It's just a description. So I went in, as I often do after seeing some little thing in my garden, and I Googled dragonflies so I could sort of see them and read about them. And when they open up their wings, those spots on their wings are called stigmas. So that word coming from stigmata was just so compelling. And I thought, that's the poem. That's the discovery, that part of their wing has that beautiful meaning. So I got my little poem out of it. I'll read a couple more from this collection. The next poem, I have Tammy Reed to thank for. Tammy loves Africa, as some of you know. You know Tammy, who was our dean of faculty for years after being a teacher for years, and now she's teaching back in our department. And we shared an office for a time last year, and at one time we're having this wonderful discussion about her trips to Africa and her love of elephants and giraffes. And she was telling me about the last visit that she had been in Africa, and this wonderful tour guide that was taking them to this herd of elephants that he has traveled or followed for years, so he knows the herd, he knows the names of all of the animals, and it was just really wonderful. But I started thinking, which is the first line of the poem, who decides the names? What does that mean when someone names a wild animal in Africa? Naming the elephants, who decides the names? Whose word for mother, aunt, father, the cinnamon shades of mud and light, and the rain which separates seasons? Who names the offspring waiting 18 months to be born, knowing weightlessness as the world they love, and the mothers swaying, feeling their bodies shimmer like the bones of the dead, what we call graveyard, where they pause for hours, not Rachel, not Leah, to listen and hear beyond the rustle of wings and air, what we call grieving. Elephants do grieve their dead. They've been documented. I've even seen pictures of them literally sitting, you know, on the body of one of their deceased family members and staying for hours at the site where the animal has died, which I just think is extraordinary. It's just so moving. I'm going to read a couple of poems that are more political, which is something that I have a great deal of interest in, reading poems. I'm reading poems right now from some grant work that I've been doing this past summer, looking at the history of the birth of Israel, what's happening in Palestine, the voices of contemporary Palestinian Arab poets and Israeli Jewish poets, which has been just an extraordinary experience, sort of as a sister study to what I've been doing with the Poets of Witness, which is mostly Eastern European post-World War II poetry. So these are a little bit more political, and then I'll come back at the end of the reading to some poems that are more lyrical, and I'll end with a couple of love poems, which is what I like to do with readings. But this is a little poem called Breath. My husband was standing at the counter cutting bread and fruit. Easy for him to walk the few steps to where I was sitting, tired at the end of the day. Easy to lean down and brush his mouth against my mouth so that we might forget for a moment the war news he had just turned on, bending the antenna above the counter where water had begun to pool beneath the tomato, the knife, the scent of tarragon our breath caught. This is called The Beginning and the End, which is an incredibly presumptuous name for a poem, but I left it. And this poem actually came out of a faculty discussion several years ago during Faculty Development Day when we did some breakout groups talking about different religions. And I went to Jim Waller's, and he was talking about Judaism, and told this really interesting anecdote about a man he had just worked with back at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., where he had been. And this man, who was Jewish, had just lost a family member and was observing certain rites of Jewish mourning that were very different than the way other people observe mourning rituals. And I think one of the things he mentioned was that as he worked, he sat on a very low stool, which was uncomfortable, as a reminder of him to think about who he had lost. I don't know if it was a father or mother or who it was, but I just was thinking about that, mourning someone for an entire year in a very, very conscious way. What do we make of the God of vengeance, the bloodshed of kings, the women running from homes without preparation? What do we make at the end of astonishment's glance, without preparation for darkness, and afterward, darkness? What do we make of the landscape where stone begat stone, where soil was lifted and carried, and the cell's transparency was lifted and carried? What do we make of the feathers, the imprint of glass, the black weather swept into floorboards? What do we make of the 27 bones of the hand, the clod of dirt, the ring? What do we make of the sun replacing his meals with morning, his evening run and the hour of bedtime reading with morning? What do we make of a father's wristwatch, a hospital window sun splintered? What do we make of the driver's license and telephone number, the heart's empty quarter, the history of voices, birthplace and geography, the blurred eye, the shoelace pulled from the shoe? When Hitler's brown shirts would attack Jews, this was before the war started, but when they would have the pogroms and the just sort of random attacks of violence, they would ransack people's apartments and homes, throw furniture into the street off balconies, and then the last thing that they would do would be to rip up their bedding. So in this poem, there's an image of the feathers and the imprint of glass. They would take the comforters and the pillows, which is sort of the last thing that one would have, you know, to wrap up in, to be warm, to feel protected, to be safe. That would be the last thing that they would destroy, which in all of the reading that I've done about the Holocaust and the poetry that came out of the Holocaust, that's one of the most horrific things I think that I've ever read. The next poem was triggered, it's called Prime Number, and it was triggered by just something that I heard on the news. This was several years ago when there was a very violent explosion, a bomb on a bus that killed, I think it was 24 very devout Jews who were just coming back from worship at the Wailing Wall. And I remember afterwards thinking about that, just one more explosion that we heard about, and I couldn't remember if it was 23 or 24 people who'd been on that bus. And I was thinking, well, it's really important that we remember that. It makes a big difference if it was 23 or 24. And I started thinking, I mean, as you think about, it's hard to backtrack and say, well, this is what started the poem, but I was, the idea of a prime number came to mind when I was thinking about the person who would plant that bus, that bomb on a bus, or who would strap explosives to herself or himself and then get onto a bus. You know, a prime number is divisible only by itself in one. And that sort of primary relationship of self and other, one life to another life, is what I was thinking about with this poem. It looks like a man wearing a shawl whose body is another shawl wrapped around a man who has already gone to his death in a subway, an office building, a chair beside a hospital bed, a man leaning against a lectern or rising from a seat on a train that is leaving a city for another city. It looks like sunrise or midnight. It looks like prayer or hunger whose table and chair is without company, without the forgiveness of bread and meat. It looks like a woman sitting on a bus where two dozen are seated at an intersection where nothing is meant to keep from occurring, where nothing is meant to return the explosion to the briefcase of work at her feet, the weight of the sweater whose sleeves cross her breasts to the dark emptiness of the body's withdrawal, shoulder and arm, the wrist and palms, volume of light, time that crosses the body's corridor, the eyes' division. Look how far you've come. I gave you a tree, and you said tree, and then cut and cut until you were hoarse with calling back the rings, back the branches. I gave you wind, and you thought it was a box, a sheet, something to cart away all you had burned. I gave you land, and you dug a pit, a canal. You dug stone from a quarry. And now look, look at the statues, one by one, how they resemble you. This is a new poem. It's a sonnet. I realized everyone is writing sonnets these days. Did you know that? They're everywhere. I thought I was doing something different. This is called I've Stopped Staying Up Late to Write Poems, which isn't really true, but I think it's a really good title. And I meant it when I wrote the poem. I'm forcing myself to get up early, to shake off these dreams, the syllables round-mouthed as the veins of trees and the clamor of water traveling upward thousands of miles. I'm forgetting sex, the mother and father, mythology, the ancient ponds. I'm forgetting weaponry and gardens, continents of endangered beak and claw, the bedroom waterfalls and basement floors where children watch for signs of redemption. Earlier and earlier, I'm refusing the psalms of the dark. I'm recanting my allegiances. As for memory, it died in a forest. I forget the ache of cold. I forget the snow where I buried its clothes. I don't have a watch on. Is there a... No. Oh, there it is. Okay. I just don't want to go over... This next poem is from the new manuscript, and it's a little poem. Carl, you'll remember Kevin Kramer. This is the poem I wrote about Kevin. This was a... My brother is here, actually, Carl. Wave so people can see you, Carl. I'm so thrilled that you're here, and my aunt is here, and my cousin is here. So, but we grew up with a family in Portland, in Tigard, and Kevin was, I think, my sister's age, so 2 years older than me. And we were, our parents were friends, and the kids kind of grew up together. And Kevin went into the military and was sledding. I don't remember how old he was, but he was just out with somebody sledding, and he hit a tree and broke his neck and was paralyzed from that moment on. And I remember I stopped to see him one time when I was in Portland. This was years and years after the accident. And it's the only time I saw him after that. And I asked him what it felt like when he felt the feeling just drain from his body. And he said, I just asked him what it felt like. And he said that he literally felt the feeling drain, just drain out of his body. And then just, as I imagined it, sort of passing into the ground. And that was it. So this little poem I wrote, it took me a long time to write this poem. How do you write a poem about someone's experience like that? And so the poem really isn't about that. It's about me trying to understand what that would feel like. After Kevin Kramer's sled hit the tree that broke his neck, he said the numbness wasn't like the cold brought by needles, or the burning waking brings to the arm still asleep. It was something else of feeling and adjacency, something else of earth and snow, transparency the mind could not replicate afterward, even when it dreamed and woke the body falling from falling. When this poem was printed in a journal, and I got the acceptance note back from someone who said that one of the other readers was a man who was a paraplegic, and he really appreciated the poem, which isn't, of course, going to guarantee its publication, but it meant a lot to me that he didn't feel that it was presumptuous. I'm going to read a dog poem. Some of you know that I have two Scottish terriers, the elegant Maud and the stalwart Lipo. I'm actually going to read a poem about Lipo that's called The Sick Dog, so I'll warn you now, it's really sad. He's sick, he's really old, but he's okay. And Maud is 5, so she's in prime form. But this is a poem that I wrote a long time ago, and it's the dog that's in this poem is Lipo. The poem is called No. The dog lay on the wet porch and watched as I dragged the shovel and rake across the yard, as I began to dig up the sod of an old bed and the rocks and lost bones he would have carried into a corner and chewed quietly until I noticed, telling him no, pulling the mask from his jaws. Time to come in, you called from the doorway, seeing the mound of vines and roots whose sterilized inches of soil I broke open 20 years ago without pause to read what water, temperature, and hemispheric zone would be required for maximum growth. Time to come in, you called again, darkness gathering in the gradual way we understand need. Nothing at the beginning. I'll read the sick dog poem. It's new, so I'm sort of trying this out on you. And then the rest of the poems will be, just a few more that I'll read, will be much more cheerful. It's called The Sick Dog. The sick dog isn't looking right. He's losing weight. He's losing fat behind his eyes, and so his eyes are sinking back into his head. And so the flow of tears, even that, is wrong. What he hears keeps growing dim. Our hands clapping are a sign for him to either go or come through the door, which is itself now a puzzle. His sound silence, like the apples shrunk inside their skins, which to him are heaven, falling and again falling into the human garden, which is his. This is a poem, again, this is my other new poem I'm going to read, and my brother, Carl, his son, is getting married, and he asked me if I would read a poem at his wedding, which I was just thrilled to think about doing, and I thought I would like to write a poem for him. So this little poem came to me. I've been working on it, and I don't know if it's good enough, but it will be, even if I don't read this at their wedding, it will be for Luke and Jana. So it's called When You Say Yes. And I mean by that when you say yes to your vows. When you say yes, let it be on a Thursday or a Sunday evening between the hours of 6 and 8. Or in the morning when children are standing on street corners waiting for a bus and the young ones are held by the hand and the older ones are holding hands for the first time. Let there be a man walking past in a blue windbreaker, and let the dog pulling at his lead be at the beginning of his life, and the man thinking of a woman's name like the title of a painting or a ribbon of apple falling from a knife. When you say yes, let it be on a Monday or a Friday, and let there be lanterns burning at the edge of the pier and couples dancing. Let there be mile markers up the west side of a mountain and down the east side. And let there be old and new green along the stretch of river where it has become your habit to stop and look for the heron, hoping to see it lift its long body slowly at an angle while you watch, and the legs dragging at first until the wings catch air. This is the heron along. Is it Rattlesnake? What's that creek out there where we drive out to see you all the time? Hangman. Yeah. My husband and I drive out there all the time. So I'm kind of infusing some family history into this poem. But there's some landmarks here of Luke's home that I hope he'll see. I'm just going to read two more poems, and they're both love poems. One of them is called, the first one's called Forgetting the Water Poem, which is about the poem that got away. You know, you're supposed to get up and write your poems down, your ideas down so you don't forget them, which I do all the time. But as I say at the beginning of this poem, I had already done that once that night. And I just thought, oh, you know, I'll remember this one. But it was beautiful, and I was going to call it the Water Poem. It was, honestly, this was a good poem. And of course, in the morning, it was gone. So I wrote a poem about forgetting it. Forgetting the Water Poem. I didn't want to wake you. I had already gotten up from bed once for something I wanted to remember. I had been holding your arm in the crook of my arm. Your sleep was shallow. You were not dreaming. Your face was like the face of a child who was reading or looking at a watch. And the dog was asleep beside us on the bed we had made where you could reach down and touch him with your fingers when he yelped and ran in the dream of running. There's nothing I remember of the water poem I wanted to keep, while the nothing of forgetting widened and darkness was what it was. You were sleeping. I didn't want to wake you. In the morning we saw that it had snowed. The view was a vast whiteness narrowed by trees and yards. The night glasses of water, when I poured them out, were full and cold. We had not touched them to our mouths. We had not left fingerprints. This last poem is called Bird Call Wave. And it was sort of given to me when Bill and I were staying at one of our favorite places on the Oregon coast, and there was this, what we came to call the 4 o'clock bird, because it came at 4 o'clock in the morning outside our room and sang the most beautiful song. I mean, just unbelievably beautiful. And I wish it was the 6 o'clock bird or the 8 o'clock bird, but it was the 4 o'clock bird. So this is for Bill. Wife, my husband said, husband, the ocean through the shades, motion and light, the near call of the bird we had begun to call, the 4 o'clock bird. Then something else, when I opened my hand and turned to the window side of the bed where he had moved, having drawn the sheet, cold and welcome, across my shoulders. Better to hear the waves. Better the bird's cry release, the way a spondee's struck sound is meant to be given and given. Not sweat and mouth. Not the orchid farmed and cut. No sound but the bird and the sea, and no bird alone but eye to eye. And then the praise that was the sea, and then the wings. Thank you very much. I think that... Pardon? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, if you want to just chat, if you can stay for a few minutes. There's some books if you want to buy a book, or just say hello. That'd be great. So thanks again for coming, and enjoy the rest of your weekend. It's a glorious evening out there, so enjoy it. I know I'm going to. So thank you.